Great. Okay. So we've got a variety of weather. We got people in Mississippi Gulf, and here in, I'm in Raleigh where it's miserable, where it's like 50 degrees and rainy. And you've got these lucky ducks down there in Tampa. It's, how is it down in Tampa?
It's raining here.
Oh, is it? Oh, but warmer, right?
But it's a lot warmer.
Yeah.
We're about 55 here in Mississippi, and I'm 20 minutes from the Gulf, but about 55 degrees, and it's very sunny, very nice. We had the rain we had yesterday.
Isn't that something? So it's coming this way. And where Glow is,
mm-hmm.
you've got snow, right? Glow.
Actually, no. In Iowa today, it is 50 and sunny, but we are supposed to get about, well, the last I heard was 4 to 6 inches of snow between tonight and tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh.
So.
Yeah, we're supposed to have a big change, too. We're supposed to be like 20-degree wind chill. And this, again, this is deep south tomorrow.
Yeah, we're going to get the wind, too. Did someone just join?
Debbie Wiesen just joined.
Hey, Debbie.
Hi, Debbie. Hi.
She's from Veterans Training School. And where?
Yeah,
what town is
the very same one.
Yes, and what city is that in?
I'm sorry.
Which town is that in?
It's in Boston, Mass.
Oh, Boston, Mass, right. Right, I remember from last time. Great.
Did someone just join?
Yes, this is Lena Miller from San Francisco, Hunters Point family.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your first name.
Lena Miller.
Lena. Hi, Lena.
Hi.
Joe Francitelli, Camden County College.
Hi, great. Joe.
Hi, how we doing?
Great, too. We got someone from Camden County, and I want to give a heads up and many thanks to Lena. The last session, she gave us a really good rundown of what was happening out at Hunter's Point, and in our post-session notes last time we talked a little bit about Hunter's Point. And before we get into that, though, we'll talk about, we've got some new people, what we do every 2 weeks. We have these informal discussions. They're just about a half hour. And they're geared at environmental job training, how to set up a program, how to keep it sustainable, how to keep it going. And when EPA issues the RFP, we'll be speaking very specifically to the EPA program and how you might best write a proposal that could be accepted. Basically, that's the same as developing a good, sustainable program. So those people who have grants can come to the calls and be mentors and maybe pick up some new bits of information that may help them in their program that the others share with them. And those people who are new can get some new ideas.
I did talk to headquarters this morning, Mike, and they tell me that the next RFP should be issued in the next week and a half. So at least they now have a little bit of a timeline.
Okay.
So maybe by the end of next week or beginning of the week after that, it should be out.
Great.
When that arrives.
Pardon me?
Oh, I just joined in when that arrives.
Winona? Okay, very good. Thank you, Winona. And someone else joined?
This is Tim at St. Louis Community College.
Hey, Tim. Great, Tim. Tim is one of our mentors, really. Tim, we have on quite a few people who are new to the program, and Tim has been there, done that, submitted these proposals, and is doing a great job in St. Louis, keeping his program going. So, Tim, Glow was just talking. She got an update from Joe, who is a project officer in EPA in Washington, said that the RFP should be out in about a week and a half. And if we look at that schedule, they really like to have these grants awarded by the summer. So if we looked at that proposal, they'd probably be issued, so we're talking about mid to late January. Probably they'll try to get a quicker response. Probably the proposals will be due in March, probably late March. first they take those proposals and they scan, they have a contractor scan through them and make sure that you qualify, that you're a nonprofit, that you're an eligible entity to submit. And those who aren't, they immediately contact them and say that they really aren't an eligible entity. And then the rest of them go into this screening process. We call it ranking criteria, and we'll be getting into that very specifically as soon as the RFP is issued. It'll be similar, a little different than last year's, but very similar, and there'll be grading points to each 15 or so questions that they'll ask you to answer very specifically. And we'll be going over all those very specific questions. We probably look forward to a grant award somewhere in July to August. And we then we have our annual grantee meeting in August. It'll probably be late August this year in Alexandria, Virginia, where we try to get all the new grantees and all the alumni grantees and current grantees together to talk about what we talk about on these phone calls, basically how to make your program sustainable, make it work. And then generally, the grants that are written will have their first training cycle either late 2012 or early 2013. The thinking being you want your first graduation class to be ready to go to work in the early spring of 2013, which is easiest to place. Did someone just join?
Yes, Ivan Groom, Manatee County.
Great, Ivan. Okay. So that's kind of the schedule we'll be sticking to. And what we'll be doing on these 30-minute calls will be basically going through these proposals, the requests for proposals, and how to do that. And actually also talking about how, for those grantees who have been there, what they've done to address some of these issues, and go from there. And I think the question we have to ask now is, what should we be doing right about now, early on in this process, and what's going to be happening in 2012? Some of you may want to, and I'll put these in the post-session notes, and I have in the past, some of the events that will be occurring in 2012. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Green Jobs, but it's a they have Green Jobs conferences around the country. Green Jobs, and it's a great website to go to. It's more encompassing than the EPA environmental jobs. It includes all kinds of green jobs. It started several years ago, and it's quite an activist group. It includes organized labor. It includes environmental groups, and they're very concerned about developing jobs in America, and particularly green jobs. Some say that almost all jobs are green, so that some of those jobs that they talk about may not necessarily be relevant to the EPA-type jobs, the environmental jobs that we're talking about. But it's a good conference to go to or get involved and get onto their website, and you can log on and become a member of the Green Job Program fairly easy. I'll put the website in there. They've got four regional meetings going on in the springtime. First one's in February 23rd in Atlanta, and then they've got one in L.A. If you're out there, Millie, or Lana, I'm sorry, if you're out in the L.A. area in March, and then in April they have one up in Philadelphia for those of you in the Camden and in that area, and then in May 10th, they've got a Green Jobs in Detroit. And there'll be some EPA people there and Department of Labor people, and they'll be talking about EPA and environmental jobs as well as other types of green jobs in the energy area. There's also going to be a NAWB conference. That's the National Association of Workforce Investment Boards, and that's going to be in March 10th in Washington, D.C. This is a meeting meant for all of the workforce investment boards. And if you're involved in one or you're working with one in your state, you may want to think about attending. It's kind of pricey. It's, in fact, it's very pricey for conferences. It costs almost like $1,000 to participate in this thing, but it's, you could go to that website and check that out. Some of the states have their own brownfields associations, and you may want to check. Ohio, for example, has one. They're going to have a their own little conference May 23rd. Florida had a very active brownfields association, and they had a meeting last month. And those are also very good programs to go to, particularly if you're interested in job training and getting involved. So what you may want to do is check and see if your state has a brownfields association. And if they do, you may want to get involved in that. One of the things I wanted to do, though, was give a heads up to Lena on the Hunter's Point discussion we had last time. It was great. She told us about some of the things going on in Hunter's Point and environmental justice issues that you've got over there. Lana, one of the things when you were talking about the environmental justice issues in on the West Coast there at Hunter's Point, which is outside San Francisco, are you aware of the environmental justice grants that are out? Is anyone aware of those?
No. Through who?
They're through EPA. There's going to be they're small. They're about $25,000, but they're environmental justice grants, and they're for communities that include education and some. There's a portion that has to do with jobs. I'll put in the notes how you might get involved in that. It's they're going to have a conference call tomorrow, but then they're going to have one on February 15th. To help applicants understand the requirements for these environmental justice awards. But it's something you might be interested in getting involved in. There are projects to support research, education, and able communities to look at the environmental health issues in their community. And they're smaller. They're only about $25,000 each, but it might be something you might want to look at.
Yes, definitely. Thank you.
I'm doing.
So can I also, you mentioned about, I just got a notice. My name is Renetta Wright from Jacksonville, Florida. Just got a advertisement from HUD. HUD has $110 million available for revitalizing communities.
Oh, awesome. This is a HUD solicitation?
Yes, mm-hmm.
And excuse me?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. And what is it for communities?
It's for revitalizing community. It's including weatherization, redevelopment, existing and new, repairs for homes.
Mm-hmm.
And so including jobs as well, the weatherization.
Okay. Weatherization has been was a very hot issue for a while, and Tim, you've been through this and talked to us about this in the past. It became a real hot issue, and a lot of training went on in weatherization, but then it kind of turned cold, didn't it? Could you tell us a little bit about what happened to you in St. Louis again?
Here in St. Louis, we had a lot of organizations that got some type of federal funding or state funding to do weatherization training. And everybody was doing something a little bit different. Not everybody got certifications or not everybody followed the same type of national standards. St. Louis is a big union town with construction. So, it just kind of – the market got flooded with people who had – a little bit of knowledge, a lot of knowledge, but nobody really knew everything.
So then the when it came time to actually get the jobs,
very few people that I know of have found jobs just doing weatherization.
Mm-hmm. We found the same thing happened in Kansas City. And I think up in the Northeast, I think there's weatherization. You want to have a red flag on that. It's there. Whenever there's big solicitations, there's a lot of people that go into it. And we found in several towns when they also in New Jersey they got into it and then they end up pretty much getting out of it because when it came down to placing the participants after they graduated, the jobs just for some reason didn't materialize.
Was there any reason why, or any specific reason why that occurred?
I think what happened was there was, and this has happened in solar also. In solar, it's a little different. You've got a lot of electricians and construction people who are out of work. And those people already have construction skills and have been trained, and they're in the business and have some contacts. So both on weatherization and solar, and even to some extent in the other green jobs, such as turbines and wind power, we're finding that a lot of the people that are coming back into that are people who were in the business before. So the construction firms, this, for example, one anecdotal situation that was referred to me was one where this was a person who built houses, and he specialized in sheetrock. This was in the case of mold. When the construction business dried up, he was pretty much out of work, but he linked up with a mold inspector who the inspector can't do the work, and this is in North Carolina, but they don't want a conflict of interest, so that person who inspects and detects the mold can't really do the remediation. So he was able, though, to link up under a separate firm as a mold remediator. Well, he basically, what he said is, this is what I do. I rip out sheetrock and I put it back in. So he was already in the business and really didn't really require any special training or very small amount of training. So those people who were trying to go fresh into the business were kind of shut out by someone here who had a whole lot of experience in the business already. To some extent, that I think is happening in the weatherization business, and it's squeezing it out, a lot of our participants. So we found that a lot of the grantees, if they do weatherization, they don't make it a key part of their program. They make it maybe a subset of their program, but you don't want to base your program strictly on that. What's going to happen this year, I believe, is there will be less emphasis on what we think of the energy green jobs and more emphasis on the environmental green jobs. So as you start thinking about how you may be responding if you're going to submit a proposal to EPA, you may want to think in terms of environmental jobs that might be in your community. Perhaps if you're going to do weatherization, do it under a separate grant that might be an addition to the EPA grant. In other words, you may have a training program that will include weatherization, but that money will come from HUD, for example, not necessarily from EPA. And knowing that that's going to be a little bit different animal, but that the EPA one will be more focused on the traditional environmental jobs. And I guess the obvious question is, what are the traditional environmental jobs? And Tim, do you want to speak to that in terms of what you see as those environmental jobs in your community?
And most of them are just some type of abatement entry level for like lead or asbestos. That's what most of the people that have come through our program, where they find work. Mm-hmm. You know, they get all kinds of different titles, but it all boils down to just the removal of either lead or asbestos or mold.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and remediation, you're exactly right. You could put a lot of words on it, remediation, But it's basically removal of the pollutants, which is what remediation is. And so lead, asbestos, mold, it might also be movement of materials. If it's soil contamination, it might be removal of the soil, and that's basically one way of treating contaminated soil is just to basically remove it. So there may be a lot of jobs in that area. Tank remediation, again, pretty much removal of the tank and the surrounding soil around it, making sure if there's a plume, if there was leakage of materials, that there are different techniques to remediate or remove the pollutant from the plume. And that's what those remediation jobs are about. So that whole category of remediation, which is basically removal of pollutants, is one that you may want to look at in your area. Some of the programs also go into sampling and analysis. And those are a little more academic, things about sampling water streams and sampling, working in wastewater treatment plants. And we've talked about this, and we won't know for sure until this RFP comes out how strong the water treatment plant position is. But there are tons of jobs in wastewater treatment plants. And I'm not sure, and I wouldn't want to say that you should gear your proposals towards that yet until we look at the RFP. But there were some hints last year that water and wastewater were going to get involved in this program. And there are some tremendous opportunities in water and wastewater in communities. We're going to have to make sure that you can address those types of jobs when the RFP comes out. But if it's in there, it's something you may want to consider. There's tens of thousands of people that are required to operate water and wastewater treatment plants. And a lot of these people have, there was a big influx in the 70s, and a lot of these people are retiring now. So there's now a whole lot of new job openings occurring. So that may be also an area you're going to want to look into. There's also environmental jobs in the regulatory area. These would be things like we call it phase one or phase two, to look at properties and see if there's contamination on them. Again, these get to be a little more academic rather than physical, where you're looking at what's been on a waste site in the past, what we call a phase one analysis. A phase one, you basically find out, for example, if there was ever a battery plant or a chemical plant or a paint plant on a piece of property. Today, you might look at, it's amazing, you look at a road, go down a road, and you see just weeds growing on the side of the road, but it turns out that maybe there was a garage there or something, or there was a paint plant or a dry cleaner at one time, and it turns out that if there was, they can detect that in a phase one. And a phase one analysis, all you do is check real estate records and see, for example, if there was ever a dry cleaner or a paint plant or what any kind of industrial operation on that property. And if there was, it gives you a strong indication there may be some pollutants on that property. And then it might lead you into a phase two. And a lot of states are requiring phase ones and phase twos be, particularly phase ones, be conducted on any real estate transaction, particularly on any industrial real estate transaction. And you may want to check into your state if phase one analyses are required in your state. And if they are, there may be something that you may want to look at in terms of part of your program, looking at training people, particularly if you're working with disabled people who could work with looking at county records and going down to courthouses and going through real estate records. They could become phase one analysts and see if there's ever been industrial production on that property. But what we're getting about in this call is what we can be doing before this RFP comes out and getting our program organized. And I think what we're trying to say is start looking at types of jobs in your communities that you may want to address. And it gets into a bigger question of starting to do this labor market assessment of getting a feel for where the openings will be in your community. Last time we talked about those program, the PLAs, we talked about setting up, finding out, for example, if there are any PLAs in your communities, and these are the labor agreements. If particularly if you're in an area where there's big projects, either government projects, or if you're in a community with a lot of organized labor going on, you may want to look at these labor agreements. And what a PLA is it's an agreement between the contractors and the owners of the property that people won't strike. There might be certain wage increases through the cost of the project, but there won't be any disruption or unexpected rate increases. And in return for this, the unions or the contractors have to often, and it's written in the PLA, they would have to offer jobs to people in the community. And there would be a community service component of this. And this is where we would get involved, in that if you can develop a relationship with, for example, if there was going to be a big dig in Boston, or there was going to be the transit system in San Francisco, there are PLAs on these big projects. They're multi-year big projects. And in those PLAs, there's a component of hiring community-based people. And even if you could get involved in the PLA, that these people would be hired from your program, it gives you an automatic entryway for all your graduates. And what it would do is they would actually help train your people and show you what skills and knowledges they're going to need, and then you would train them to that, and then they could move into apprenticeships, paid apprenticeships, and into jobs on these big projects. So one of the general things you may want to check out is, are there any projects, big projects, coming up in your community? Up in Camden, you probably have some PLAs because of all the big projects you've got going on up there. And if there are labor agreements, what you want to do is check and see what they're doing. Almost all of these have a community development component. And see, call them on it, find out who's involved in these, and find out what is the terminology in this labor agreement and how you might be able to get involved in as a feeder to these projects. One of the related to the PLA, a question that came up last time also was this question: does an apprenticeship count as a job? And Glo talked to Joe, project officer, about that, and he basically said EPA considers a job if he comes out of graduate if they're paid. So that doesn't shut off going into apprenticeships, but it would mean that they would get paid as part of their apprenticeship. So if you have a program, we had people from Boston who were concerned about people coming out of their program and going into an apprenticeship program. You want to make sure that they're going to get paid when they get out. And if they do, then that would be counted as a placed position.
What that does cut out, though, is the students that go on for more education. Those students cannot be counted because they're not being paid.
Right.
According to what headquarters told me.
Right. So as you're designing your program, you can't really design it as a program that would be a pre-associate's degree program where they would come out of your program and then go into the community college, which is unfortunate. But that's the way EPA is looking at this. They want people to get out of this program and get jobs, which could be an organized labor job, with some pay, and it could be an apprenticeship, but it has to be paid. That's okay. We can work around that. What we want to do, though, and probably by the next meeting, the RFP will have come out, but between now and the next meeting, I would start looking at these global things in your community. What kind of demand do you see coming up in the next year? Are there some big civic projects going on? Are there big? I would also look into the water, wastewater area. Don't put too much emphasis on this until we get a clearer vision of how involved they're going to be in the EPA program. But you might want to make some phone calls in terms of your wastewater treatment plant operators and how do they expect a lot of retirees coming up. And I think they're going to say yes. The next question is, how are they being trained? And they may say, well, we're training them on the job. And then you may want to ask the question, well, if we started a job training program, could we act as a feeder for your potential hires? And they may say yes or no. But this is a good time to find that out because there is a huge potential for wastewater treatment plant operators and water treatment plant operators coming up. And you may need to just get these questions out of the way so that when it's time to start writing these proposals and we get down to the nitty-gritty, whether you want to go in that direction or not. The same goes for your weatherization project. I would be very careful if you're going to go into weatherization. If you do it as a sideline. But I'm afraid that every community is different. You have to look at the needs in your community. But I would be very concerned, given what's happened in recent history on terms of weatherization, whether or not there's going to be jobs in your community. And if you get money for it, you may want to pursue this HUD money rather than the EPA money, because they tend to throw massive amounts of funds at things like weatherization. And I would save the EPA jobs, start looking at types of jobs that might be more environmentally oriented, that are, like Tim said, either things that remove the pollution, the remediation jobs, or the things that assess the pollution, which are the sampling and analysis jobs, or the types of jobs that are regulatory in nature, like phase one, or inspection type jobs that you may want to look at in your community and kind of go from there. So, well, we do want to keep these down to 30-minute conversations, and this week is kind of a getting back to the program, and next week we're going to get into, or 2 weeks from now, which will be the 25th of January, we'll have another call, 30 minutes, and by that time, we'll probably have the RFP out, and we'll start talking about responding to this RFP that hopefully will have recently been issued.
And when that gets issued, Mike, I will also put a posting on the listserv, and we'll put it on the Brownfields Toolbox website.
Great. I'll put up the website for the environmental justice grant solicitation, and we'll get you the websites for the Green Jobs conferences and the National Association of Workforce Investment Board conferences. We'll have that on there. Anyone have anything they want to contribute or say at this today? Okay. Okay. Well, what we'll do is if you could mark your calendar for about 30 minutes on the 25th at 2 o'clock, and we'll start talking about the RFP then. So thanks for attending, and we'll talk to you all soon. Okay?
Thanks everybody.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Bye.